Today we are going down under and meeting up with Richmond Heath. He is a physiotherapist and the founder of TRE Australia. I hope you like stories, because we've got lots of them for you today. Winding, twisting, beautiful stories that start off in darkness, pain, and death, and blossom into pleasure, beauty, connection, and life. Pop into this teepee, grab a seat around this campfire, and listen in. He's here. He's here. It's Richmond Heath. Recently, your teacher, your shaman Diva Dericha, died recently. And this might be a weird way to start a podcast. You know, nice to meet you. Death. But this is an important moment in your life and in the world. What are the biggest lessons that you learned from shaman Diva Dericha?
Yeah, look, it's a really significant time. He was one of many different sort of elders that I have, you know, had the privilege to learn with or under and different elements. And probably a couple of the key things, and it's been really fascinating for me because I did a bit of work with him many, many years ago. I did some of his five-day shamans programs. He was the founder of him and his wife at the time, were the founder of the Centre for Human Transformation in Australia, which was a intentional community, one of the most successful in Australia, I've heard, coming out of the lineage of Osho and the Orange People. And so I did a bit of work with him many years ago, but then it's only been in the last sort of 4 or 5 years I had a lot more time with him, and it's been much more as friends and him encouraging me rather than in that teacher-student role, because when I was in that place, I had a lot, you know, had my authority issues coming up, and so there's always a little bit of a competition and a battle, and as we would say, or as I like to say in Australia, it's like big dog-itis, who's trying to be the big dog, which was quite fun, actually. We had a lot of fun with it. But when I reflect upon some of the things that I've got from him, and you know, one of the first things is it's been a huge opening inside me. And his name that he took, Dericha, means in Urdu, means opening or window, you know, a portal. And I've just been finding that since he passed away, I've been having these extraordinary shifts and changes inside myself, like that I hadn't experienced when he was alive, or the different things we were doing, whether it was breath work or body work. So a couple of key things. The first thing I'd say, and he was very extreme. He was a really tough, hard man. The first thing was, I sum it up like this: run as hard and as fast as possible towards your deepest fears. He was like merciless and unrelenting in targeting, and had an amazing skill to be able to target into your deepest wounds and dig around in there. I like the term debridement, like when you've got a wound that's infected, you've got to go in and cut the dead material off, and it hurts and it's painful, but it's debrided and you come out the other side with a little bit more freedom. So that was one of the things that I really learned, being someone that I've lived most of my life with high-functioning anxiety. So my default pattern is to run away or avoid things that are uncomfortable and, you know, not entirely, but really diving in, because the sooner we can confront and engage and connect with and integrate and move through these deepest fears inside us, the closer and the sooner we get to a place of freedom within ourselves. So that was really one of the first things that I took away. Another really key one was that he was really, and I saw him say this to many, many people at different times, validating your own experience. So when I went to do these shaman doorway programs, I'll just tell you, I'll try to keep it a short story because there's a lot of great depth. So when I went into this shaman's doorway, I think it was a 5-day men's sort of, you know, the first initiation into the shamanic way of being, and I was feeling incredibly insecure. So just so insecure about, am I man enough? Am I, you know, all of these different things. And I was walking up the pathway to the center, and the first guy who came down the hill and met me had a pair of jeans on, and he looked like Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise. He was like super cut, super fine, hairy chest. He was just like the ultimate, you know, young stallion. And I just remember shrinking and thinking, oh, my God, I'm a bit fat, my hips are a bit wide, whatever. So my insecurities just got more. The second guy that I ran into on the way up the hill was a professional actor in Australia. So you can imagine he's like got this beautiful face and just, you know, stunning features. And I'm just like, oh, I'm just getting more and more anxious and insecure. And we went into the teepee and there was a whole lot of us sitting in the circle. And Diva was saying, okay, I'm going to do this drum journey. I'm going to beat this drum. I'm going to keep beating the drum and you're going to just listen to the drum. At the end of the drumming, I'm going to ask you a question. So I'm sitting there, my little brain's thinking, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't know if I can do it. My brain's just on hyper alert because I'm feeling so anxious around these other men, with a lot of them had done a lot of these programs before. So the drum's going, doom, 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 doom. Goes for a long time. And he says, what is your name? Bang, instantly. There's a name comes into my head and I just shrink. I'm like, oh, my God, no, that can't be it. I've got to think of a different name. Because it was, you'll understand in a moment. So we go around the circle and the first person, he says, you know, what is your name? And the guy says, oh, you know, my name is Leaping Deer or some kind of shamanic Native American-y sort of thing. And the whole group says, aho, Leaping Deer. And the next guy, they're like, what is your name? I don't know, the Void from Beyond or something. It's just getting more and more sort of shamanic. And with every person as it's coming around towards me, I'm getting more and more shrinkage happening in my whole being. And it's all very heavy and serious and powerful. And then they get to me and he says, what is your name? And I say,
Baby Worm.
No, I say, Barry. And the whole room just erupts and starts laughing at me. They're like, Barry. And they're like, oh, ho, Barry. And I'm just,
oh, no.
I'm just thinking, oh, my God, I'm such a loser.
Like back in high school again.
My brain's trying to. Anyway, the next person after me is like, I don't know, some, you know, mystical being of something. So it just keeps going on. We did this another three or four times where we'd have to answer, and the second time was, why, where are you from? And bang, my answer straight away is here. And I'm like, how embarrassing. It's like, oh my God, I'm Barry, I'm from here. Everyone else is Leaping Deer from the beyond or the great, you know, eternal sunlight or some shit. And anyway, so we get to the end of it, and then the very fourth time we do it, so I've just had to sit in the insecurity of these answers, and I'll never forget this. And so it's the fourth question. So it's like, you know, who are you? Where are you from? I have forgotten the third one. And the last one is, you know, why are you here and what do you bring? So everyone's got all these amazing shamanic things. And I go, I'm Barry. I'm from here. I'm just here because, and I bring love. So every time I speak, the whole room erupts in laughter at me. And then just at the end of that, when he said that, when I said that, he just looked me in the eye and he said, that's really fascinating because I bought this property off Mr. and Mrs. Barry. And in that moment, in that instant, I was like, hang on, I'm connecting in with something here that's very real and very present and picking up on, you know, let's say things in the ethers or whatever you want to say. And I had done a fair bit of time working in Indigenous Australian cultural. I'd done a course in that, an advanced diploma, and then I'd worked on a place called the Lingalonga Aboriginal Philosophy Farm. So I had knowledge and a bit of an understanding about these sort of things. So, again, this is feeding into this sense of validating your experience. You know, I'm going, bang, there it is, but I'm so insecure about owning that and stepping into that. And, Michael, it was only a couple of – it was probably only 6 months ago, this is maybe 10, 15 years later, when I was meeting up with Doreetha and we're having a cup of tea and I was recounting that story because it was like this funny story that I'd always had. And he gave me another piece of information which I didn't know about. And what that was that not long before that shaman's doorway that I was attending, one of his closest friends, Barry Young, had just passed away. So I didn't find out until 10 or 12 years later. I was only thinking about, oh, I'm tuning in with this land here from the Mr. and Mrs. Barry. And for him, he's going, there's some kind of connection in there with this, you know, this instant connection with this guy, Barry Young. So he was always really big when we were doing breath work and people would have an experience or have an insight. And, you know, we would bring it forwards And he'd be like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm making this up, or, you know, I'm really, it would just be like, validate the reality of your experience. It doesn't mean you have to say it's true. You just go, this is exactly what I experienced and what I thought. So to give you an example, this morning I was doing a breathwork session, just self-led, conscious, connected breathing. And I had all this tension, long-term pattern in my middle of my spine. And as I was doing the breathwork, at some point, it sort of started to come to me of the experience of being stuck in the birth process, where the story my mother had always told was she was driving to the hospital. It was like a 3-hour drive. It was a foggy night, so it took 5 hours. So it was like I was coming out, my body was coming out, but she was holding me in because she wanted to wait to the hospital. And I'd heard this story before, and I'd done lots of things about, oh, there's these deep patternings inside my physiology. But what I experienced this morning was I could feel this sense of a pressure pushing me from my feet, the end of my feet. And it occurred to me that in that moment, I had my mother's uterus, or let's call it her spontaneous, organic wisdom of her body, trying to push me out. At the same time, I had my mother's, let's just call it her conscious ego, or a will, or a fears, trying to hold me in. And I was stuck in this place. And when you're compressing the spine from either end, you're going to get a weak point's going to start to buckle or bend. And that's where I had all this tension. And I remember just coming out and straight away, I was breathing, and I kept breathing, and I could feel that frustration and anger at my mother. Like, you know, gee, your body was trying to push me out. I was wanting to come out, and you were holding me back because of your fears and that deep frustration. And then as I kept breathing, the next experience I had was, wow, Mum was only holding me in because she was scared. So she wasn't choosing to do that. And all of a sudden the tears flow and I feel this deep empathy for my mother. And then I keep breathing and all of a sudden that frustration's gone. I'm like, wow, yeah, you know, I'm angry, I'm scared. We're all like this. No one's choosing to have these, you know, effects on other people. It's all just the great dance of, you know, play of life, as Muktananda would say. And then as I kept breathing, then I had more experiences around the culture that I was born into. So the medicalization of birth, circumcision, all these different things, and that those people hadn't been able to support my mother and me in birthing in a really free, graceful way. And so instantly then I had a whole lot of frustration and anger about these people who are supposed to be experts who are not giving my mother the real deep information that she needs to be able to have a nice, graceful birth. And then the same thing. So I feel that, I keep going. It was coming to the end of the session. So I could feel intellectually that I knew that, you know what, none of those people are bad people. They're not deliberately trying to hurt me or, you know, do that. They're just, we're all a product of our environment and our culture and the elders before us. So on an intellectual level, I could get that, but I didn't have that yet, have that same release of embodied acceptance. So I know I'm going a long way around here. So what I'm saying is it's about validating the experience. And it was one of the first times when I was doing breath work with Dorica and the people at the center, you know, where we started to really go, our body remembers and accesses all of these patterns. You know, from a neuroscientific viewpoint, our brainstem and our limbic system fully online in second trimester. So even though I've got no cognition, you know, in that cognitive thinking sense, the body has got all those patterns and all those potentially unresolved processes. So that was just incredibly, and as I say, since he's died, I feel more strongly able to just stand in my own authorship and speak from my own truth and not be so frightened and validate, look, this is the reality of my experience. That how I make sense of it might not be real. And then the other couple of really two big things that I got out of him, which I think are critical. The first one is about circumcision and the absolute trauma of circumcision. And I'll never forget, it was probably the first time I met him, he came to a men's group that I was involved in and he gave a talk on circumcision. And I'll never forget him pulling his pants out and showing us his penis and go, look, I'll show you my scar. See how the second half of my penis is pink and red? It's not the same color. He's going, that's actually a scar. Up until that point, I'm like, oh, that's just what penises look like, because everyone
dude, I think I have a little scar too. My mom pointed it out to me, which is kind of weird, your mom's pointing out your circumcision scar, but yeah. I remember I forget about it. I ignore it, but I think I have one too. It doesn't affect me, but yeah, it's there. So maybe deep down, it is still there. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. So he started to, again, bring this awareness of these deep primal wounds and traumas that in our Western culture, we just forget about and pretend it doesn't happen. So, for example, up until 1974, in Australia at least, but often around the world, circumcisions were done without anaesthetic because the belief at the time was because there's no cognition in the baby, they can't feel pain, except that every baby that gets circumcised generally will either scream or try to scream and get frozen and contain the scream. The second sort of myth is that, you know, it's a foreskin, like on an adult, so you just pull it forwards and snip it off. It's just a little snip. But at birth, the foreskin is actually connected to the glands of the penis in the same way that your thumbnail is connected to the bed underneath your thumbnail. So what happens is that it has to be prized off, literally torn out, like putting bamboo stakes under your thumbnails. This is ludicrous. And I remember sitting in that talk and all of a sudden my penis starts to burn. I'm like, I can feel these things. And a little bit later he says, some of you guys listening to this have been circumcised. You'll start to feel pain. Your scar will get activated. These memories will come up. And then in recent years, I've learned a lot more about the effects of that on the skin on the glands of the penis. Instead of being like the inside of your cheek where it's the head of the penis is an internal organ. It's meant to be covered by skin and only come out during intercourse. So in an intact male, if you put your finger inside your cheek and you feel the soft, supple, moist skin in there, that's what it's meant to be like. But once you've been circumcised, it becomes more like the skin on the outside of your cheek. We also lose the sensation and feeling because that starts to go hard and numb. And then we also lose the gliding mechanism so that sex starts to become something that requires a lot of sliding for stimulation rather than the internal stimulation between three layers of skin. The most sensitive nerve innervated skin in the entire male human body. We tend not to think about it. We mentioned female genital mutilation and people just instantly feel that is absolutely abhorrent. We talk about circumcision. We call it circumcision. We say, oh, yeah, it's not a big deal. So he introduced me to that. And then the other really critical piece of information that he and his partner, Roshana, introduced to me was the process that happens in our first breath at birth when we have the placenta able to pulsate and continue to send oxygen through into our body, into our lungs. So before we're born, you know, 30, 40, 50% of the total blood volume in the placenta and the baby is in the placenta. And when we come out and then our airways hit air and they start to breathe, when we're in utero, there's no blood. There's very little blood in the airways, in the lungs, because it's not required. We're getting oxygenated through the placenta. And so what happens there is as the airways start to open up and try to breathe, the placenta is sending oxygenated blood into the baby. And there's this feedback loop so that as the baby starts to breathe, say the first breath is like 1% baby's getting the oxygen, 99% the placenta. And then with the next breath, it might be 2% the baby, 98%. The next few breaths, 10%. And gradually the placenta withdraws the blood flow and the oxygenation based on the oxygenation starting to happen in the baby. So when we clamp the cord, it's literally like if you're sitting there now and I came and put my hand over your mouth, instantly your air supply is cut off and your first breath becomes a breath for pure survival, a life and death experience. And also at that time, you've got to get blood to your lungs, which would normally come through the placenta from somewhere that gets drawn from the peripheries of the body, which is an experience of extreme cold akin to shock. So what I'm saying here is, some of the learnings that I really take away from him is the impact of these. We just think that's normal science, you know, normal medicine that then start to have on our physiology in later life, but also our relationships and our dynamics, you know, how we feel, like how I feel towards my mother, how I feel towards not at a conscious level, but at an unresolved trauma level. It's a very long answer. And the last thing I would say is he was very much a trickster, a coyote, Hayoka. And he was incredibly funny and fun, which meant that everything didn't have to be serious and heavy all the time. You could have a complete laugh. So I actually feel since his passing, I almost, I'll validate this. It sounds weird to say. I feel like there's been some kind of transmission where I have just got more self-authorship in myself, more trust in myself, more solidity to speak these sort of things that I'm speaking about than I've ever had before. So it's been quite an extraordinary gift in his passing.
Wow, I want to go in like 100 different directions now, which weren't even any part of the original plan, but wow, this is so much here. But just to kind of squeeze a little bit more out of that is my mom died last year, and I felt my perception of, well, myself, but I felt more my perception of the world changed. My perception of other people changed. I started to, like, I would see, before I saw elderly people or people who are sick or walking funny or in wheelchairs, and I just thought, well, I didn't think anything of it. It's just sort of an object in the world or something. But somehow I felt, although that energy from my mom died and went somewhere, like I felt more connected to the rest of the world. And maybe it was partly that I entered the darkness, I embraced and went straight into that jungle where a lot of people they run away from it. So I was at the funeral, for example, and a lot of people weren't crying. They were just stoic I don't know why. I'm not saying this is better, I'm better or worse, but I let it out. I cried. I wasn't scared, and I was like, I don't know if I went fully into the darkness. You know, it is a dark topic, but I think by going through that tunnel at the end of that was like this brighter, more vibrant kind of life where I was more connected, a few months later, I started this podcast almost spontaneously. It kind of just came out of me, even the name itself, the imagery. I never really thought of this word shaman, but then, I was watching this YouTube video of your teacher you were just talking about, and I was like, whoa, this is what a shaman is? I was like, yes, this is it. It's all kind of coming together, but I don't know, I'm rambling a bit now, but how did your perception of other people or the world change after his death?
Well, I wouldn't say so much that my perceptions changed, but when you talk about that darkness and going into, basically what you're saying is you were grieving, and in grieving we have a natural pulsation between the sorrow and the celebration. But as you're saying, Western culture, we don't grieve. We hold it together and we hold it in. So that, what that does, though, is links me back to another teacher a teacher and colleague and friend of mine, David Burselli, who was the founder of TRE. And for those of you who don't know, TRE, sort of tension and trauma release exercises, where we're deliberately invoking spontaneous shaking and tremoring in the body and perceiving that shaking as a recovery response of well-being rather than a symptom of stress or anxiety. But when we talk about our perspective, one of the key things that David Burselli was, when he's talking about this shaking reflex as a trauma recovery process, was this concept that trauma is an evolutionary process on the planet. We all naturally, our egos don't want trauma. We want to avoid it. We want to prevent it. We want to do everything. But when we go into traumatic experiences, if we're able to integrate them and digest them, then we often grow and evolve both as individuals and also as humans, as a culture on the planet. So since Dariche has passed away, I just feel like that's become more secure and more solid and more central in my life. I liken it to, in some of my work, I will tell a story of saying, there's a little rose bush. The rose bush is growing and it's loving life and it's fantastic. And then all of a sudden it sees this pair of secateurs or pruning shears, and they're coming towards it. And it's like, no, 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 keep it away. Don't get, it's going to, it's terrified. Snip, off falls the edge of the branch. Oh my God, I'm traumatized. This is terrible. 6 or 8 months later, there's this beautiful flower grows. It's like, wow, look at this amazing flower. It's got no idea that it's got anything to do with the pruning. The flower grows, same time comes around next year. Oh my God, there's those secateurs again. Keep them away. Terrible. This process goes on. We get the pruning on the other side. There's the blossoming. But it takes many, many years and practice and having that model of understanding for people to go, right, this is going to hurt. If I surrender to it, if I let myself go into it, there's going to be some gold. It's the dark night of the soul. It's the hero's journey that in our Western culture and our Western medical model, we pretty much try and prevent and discount and avoid people going through those processes. So eventually, you know, the little rose bush is there going, oh my God, there's those secateurs again. I know this is going to hurt, but I know it's going to bring this beautiful flower on the other side. So I surrender. I fall into it. I sometimes call it, you know, surrendering to the great secateurs of life or something. So this perception that those things that scare me, anger me, overwhelm me, traumatize me, I don't want them any more than anybody else. But when they're occurring, there's an opportunity to allow those processes to take me inward to get more connected to myself. And from that place where I'm more embodied, more enlivened, there's more vigor in my life, if I'm able to digest and integrate that process, I come out on the other side a little bit more strong, a little bit more authentic, a little bit more grounded. And so that rather than spending my whole life trying to prevent stress, anxiety, trauma, overwhelm, there's more capacity. I have more capacity now than ever to embrace it. Even to embrace that I don't want this, get it away from me, just to live in that moment and surrender into that moment to know that there's a process that will be going through.
Is this what you mean when you say that trauma is a verb? You messaged me saying trauma is a verb. Is that kind of what you mean by that? And if not, can you just kind of dig into that more? Why is trauma a verb?
Yeah. So, look, it's not directly, but it does link directly. So the concept is most of my life, when people talk about trauma, they'll talk about the external event. This happened or that happened or whatever, whatever. People will talk about, oh, I've got a bucket full of stress and my bucket's filled up. People will say trauma's stuck in the body. It's energy trapped in the body that hasn't been released. So there's this concept that trauma is a noun. It's not me. It's something inside me that I've got to get out of me. Whereas when we look at the way the body responds to stressful and traumatic events, going into mobilization or immobilization, the reason I say trauma is a verb is because what's happening is what we call trauma. Like if someone says, I've got unresolved trauma, well, what is it that you've actually got? For want of a better word, we've got a nervous system which is actively creating defensive responses now in response to stimuli that are often not actually dangerous because of associated memories that are still coupled from past experiences. So if I was bitten by a black dog when I was a little child and it's not integrated and resolved, everything to do with dogs starts to fire my nervous system off into a flight response. Then I just say, I've got anxiety or I've got a phobia. So it becomes a thing. I've got this. Rather than going, in this moment, my nervous system is responding to the external environment by actively creating a flight response, which we call anxiety, but we don't think about like we go, I've got anxiety. It becomes a thing. So when we understand that, we go, right. So our stress and our trauma is a pattern that the nervous system is generating in the moment. Rather than I've got 40 years of trauma, it's going to take me 40 years to process all my material, we're going, my nervous system is activating itself in a certain way right now, none of it conscious. Wow, how can we interrupt that or retrain it or repattern it to help the body and the nervous system to come back into a grounded, safe place right here in the moment? And David Berselli, I'll never forget when he was saying this, over the last 15 or 20 years, there's been this great development where instead of trauma being just purely mental health and psychological and cognitive behavioral, we're starting to understand the role of the body in trauma. So there's all these, you know, the body bears the burden, the body remembers, the body keeps the score, all these books. But then what we tend to do is to go into cognitively directed therapeutic techniques to try and unwind it. And I'll never forget David at one of the workshops, people were talking about trauma and they're talking about safety. And he said, yeah, trauma's in the body, but so is safety. Further in the body, underneath the trauma patterns. So this sense of being able to connect that there's something deeper than what's organizing those defensive responses, which is keeping us alive. So I'm not sure yet how that links back, but what I love about that sense of understanding trauma is a verb is it's like, right, my body's actively creating this in the moment. Am I consciously choosing to have tight shoulders, leaky cells in my guts, a restricted heart rate and respiratory? Of course not. Am I choosing to feel anxious or angry or overwhelmed? Of course not. All those processes are subcortically or subconsciously generated by the, let's just say subcortically by the brainstem and the limbic system, for want of a better word, by the organism or by the body itself. And David said this at a workshop once, doesn't it make sense if we've got these automatic subcortical, subconscious processes that the body goes into to protect us, that it would have the capacity to come out of those defensive responses in the same subcortical, subconscious way? And that's where the spontaneous shaking and trembling that we're activating in TRE, or there's lots of other techniques like somatic experiencing or bioenergetics or core energetics. There's lots of cultural practices around the world like Katsujin Undo, Seiki Jutsu, Kalahari Bushmen call themselves the keepers of the shake. There's all different ways of interpreting it. But how this links back to this concept of the dark night of the soul is that which is unresolved and which is keeping us suffering and burdened is within us, a pattern within us. Now, most of us in the Western culture and our elders have taught us that the best way to live life is to consume, avoid, and to not journey inwards and go into and face and move through those patterns that are still unresolved in the physiology of the body, which sometimes don't feel comfortable. It's normal for our ego to try and avoid. We would always just choose to have pleasure and do things that are pleasurable. And that's one of the great gifts of this TRE process, is when we activate the body's own organic wisdom to determine where and how and what moves and what shakes, my conscious mind is not leading that process. The organic wisdom and the urge or the desire for our organism to be as healthy and as efficient and as free as possible is what's leading that process, even if my ego doesn't want to have to feel a bit of anxiety or a bit of anger or whatever. There's a TRE provider in Perth called Tony Fitzgerald who once had this great quote where we were talking about, saying, Tony, people come to our workshops, they have this tremor experience, they feel amazing, it's incredible, and then 6 months later you might see them and they're like, have you been doing any TRE? They go, oh, no, I've been too busy. I haven't any time. We're like, how can it be that people are learning this process, having these experiences, and then not continuing it? And I'll never forget the cafe we're in, and he said, I think it's because you don't do TRE. TRE does you. And by that, what he means is instead of my ego consciously going, I'm going to do yoga and Pilates to make myself feel this, the body is generating the movements and it's leading the healing process in the same way that the body is unconsciously generating our defensive responses. So it gives us an opportunity to literally go into, the dark night of the soul within us, to go into our own grief and unresolved grief, which in my opinion is a great word to replace trauma. Instead of saying I've got trauma, just say I've got unresolved grief. To go into that process, to let it move us, to let it open us so that on the other side we can find some new freedom and some new groundedness and some new physiological maturity in our nervous system and psycho-emotional maturity in our psycho-emotional world.
So if it is a verb, it's not an active verb. It's more like it's passive verb. And usually, I know I'm just continuing this verb metaphor, but usually verbs are connected to subjects. There's a subject, a person, for example, doing an action. And in this case, this isn't exactly a normal kind of verb. It's some passive verb. And there doesn't appear to be any sort of subject performing the action. And if there is, maybe there is. It's something larger than us. It's gravity or it's some life force. It's chi. I don't know. Just to continue this metaphor, where is the subject? Where is all that?
Yeah, great. So think about this. When you go to sleep tonight, Michael, what keeps you alive? It's not you. You're asleep. You're not there doing it. When you're in utero and when there's a sperm and an ova, what is it that gets that sperm to swim towards the ova? What is it that gets that ova to open into the sperm? What is it that says we're going to put the head up here and the legs down there and the arms down there? That's what's generating That's what's doing this verb. And why that's so important is because most of the time we're saying, oh, gee, I've got a tight shoulder. That's wrong. That's bad. That's pathology. Yeah, it's uncomfortable, but the organism knows why that's there. We then judge it in our ego and say, that's wrong. I should be more open. I should be more free. Versus, I am where I am, and my organism and my life force, whether you want to call it life force, whether you want to call it your prana, your chi, your spirit, your kundalini, whatever, people interpret it in completely different ways. In a sense, that's what is doing the verb. And so we start to get into that sense of, right, well, there's me, like I can volitionally, consciously move my arm, but when I relax and let go, my arm will move itself. Wow, I'm being moved by this, whatever you want to call it. You know, I often refer to it as life force or the organic wisdom of the body. David Berselli calls it a tremor mechanism. You know, it doesn't really matter because at the end of the day, whatever it is doesn't give two hoots what we call it. It doesn't give two hoots whether we can understand it or explain it, because we all want to try and interpret and say, oh, this is what's happening. It's this neurological process. You know, so now we understand what it is. But realistically, Michael, in 5,000 years' time, right, in 5,000 years' time, if humans are still alive on the planet, they will be looking back at our interpretation of what's happening in the world and our neuroscience, and they will be laughing at their heads off at the dark ages that we were in, that we had so little understanding about what was going on. Whereas we're here going, oh, we understand everything with science. We can prove it all. We understand what's going on. Well, we have layers of knowledge and information, but they're really only lenses that we're looking through. So rather than us getting so attached to, oh, we need to understand what's happening.
Even in the future, we'll look at like, oh, we are thinking like nervous system, dopamine,
yes,
all these words. Like we're going to say, what nervous system versus a circulatory system versus a respiration, yes, system? What are you guys talking about? Dopamine? Come on, guys. You know, I think that might happen, right?
That's right. And so one of the fascinating things, and I mean, the thing for me is I go, look, science is just the religion of the day and it's the language of the day. You know, some people speak English, some people speak French, we speak science. So often when I'm running workshops, what will happen is I'll talk about the spontaneous shaking as a recovery response from trauma and the nervous system down-regulating, because most people relate to that. If I've had a car accident or a shock and my body starts to shake, well, that's true. But eventually we get to the point I say, look, all of that is just a story to keep your ego happy, to keep your ego prepared to surrender into the spontaneous movements, because when we are in utero, from very, very early on in utero, our body spontaneously shakes and tremors and moves itself. And the muscles, they're called myoclonic twitches, so in the muscular sort of structure, it moves itself before it's even connected to the nervous system. The movements in utero are generated by what? We're back to the life force wisdom or something, you know, the life force. And it's the movement.
Maybe, but it might be like the movements of the mother, which is moved by something larger, the heartbeat and stuff of her. And so you're like in this messiness of this meltingness of verbs, and you're like pure verb at that point almost. It's like you're like this baby, but you're purely being moved by that natural energy. And it's, I know I'm kind of going in a different direction, but it's actually quite interesting because your memory of, it wasn't a cognitive memory, but it's a bodily memory of being in the utero. We don't get that because within our bodies, everything is overall always flowing and moving and stuff, but we sort of see things from the outside. But if you can experience from the inside, you're like, whoa, that kind of gives you a sort of lens into like, oh my God, how much movement is going on inside there. And I guess you somehow remembered it, which is like amazing because you traveled to this land and you kind of brought back this memory of like, how, what it's like to be a baby in the uterus. We forget about that, but what's it like to be a freaking baby?
Mm.
Oh my God. And then we turn into nouns, we get stiffer and stiffer, and we take on roles and adjectives as we get older. And also society itself, it seems like as civilizations grow, they start off like moving and dancing like the guys, the Kalahari Bushmen,
yep,
or the samurai back in the day. And then we kind of get more and more rigid and more and more rigid, and we become nouns. This is my job. This is my role. And I am smart. Yep. I have trauma. And the verb is basically not the point anymore. It's all nouns and adjectives and stiffer and rigid and rigid. And this is crazy because that's what popped in my head when you're talking about that baby experience, which we never talk about. But yeah, go wherever you want with this because this is good stuff.
Yeah, oh, it's great.
Talk more about the baby stuff. I mean, I think that's amazing because I don't know. I don't have any other chance to really talk about what's it like to be a baby in the utero or what's it like to be a baby.
Before before we go there, let me give you another analogy, right? So when mammals go into hibernation, their nervous system, for want of a better word, their heart rate, their respiration, everything shuts right down to complete survival mode. They might have a heartbeat every 10 seconds. They might have a breath every 15 seconds. Who knows? It's, you know, it all shuts down. But again, when you watch animals come out of hibernation, they're completely unconscious. But their body starts to shake and tremble. Then everything starts to speed up and the heart rate speeds up and the breath speeds up and then it shakes some more and then blood flow starts to return. And then somewhere down the process, their eyes open and they're back awake. But again, what I'm pointing towards here is, what is it that is determining when it's time for that organism to wake up, to come back out of hibernation, out of survival mode? It's got nothing to do with the conscious mind. Again, let's call it the organic wisdom of the body. But importantly, it's in relationship with the world around it. And this is something I was reflecting before coming on the talk as I was driving home from a Pilates class. That sense of, for me, you know, healing is the process of changing our relationship with ourselves, with others, and with the world around us. Both the past memories, pre-memories of the future, and most importantly, how we are in the moment. What I mean by that is, you know, if I got bitten by that black dog, I don't have to get rid of it. I don't have to pretend that didn't happen. But it's about uncoupling my body's responses now to that memory and going, that's finished, that's over, that's complete, I'm here now, and connecting to this deep safety that's inside us in the moment. So one of the things I love about TRE is the level of empowerment, because rather than saying, hey, you have to come and see me, I've got all the wisdom. I'm the shaman that's going to heal you, or I'm the physio that's going to heal you, or I'm the psychotherapist that's going to heal you. Again, not to discount the value of all those professions, because we know the value of them, but ultimately there's something inside us which is really doing that healing and doing that reorganization. And then we start to get very esoteric, because is it actually something inside us, or is it, you know, someone was talking to me the other day about grace. Wow, something outside ourselves, some bigger force, some, you know, then it really starts to open a can of worms. It's like, what is it that's animating us all and moving us all, bigger than our own individual life force? Yeah, you can call it the universe or the Big Bang or God or who knows, but there appears to be something that's kind of moving us all. You know, life force, life, whatever we want to call it.
And we're moving in a certain way, like we're kind of undulating, right? We're kind of like, it's like vibrational in and out, expansion, contraction kind of.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of things go that way. And we go through like this way throughout our lives and throughout our day. What was your big coming out of hibernation moment, if you can consciously remember? When did you come out of hibernation?
That is brilliant. It's so I'm so thankful you've said that, Michael, because I've never thought of it like this before. I tell this story all the time, but I've never actually thought of going, oh, right, that was me coming out of hibernation. So when I grew up, I describe myself as someone with high functioning anxiety. You know, I'm like a high-level violin or a Formula One car, like can have high performance, but I need conditions to be perfect at any little variation. Yes. So a lot of anxiety internally. Externally, I was playing high-level elite sport. I was playing, you know, doing really well at school. I was doing physio, all that sort of stuff. But internally, I was burning down and burning out. My life, when I got to about 30, was grinding to a halt. And the way I used to make myself feel good was primarily through exercise. Was, you know, to keep my mental health going, and physically was basically sex or masturbating was the only way I could physically release the stress and tension inside me, because the exercise only had a certain limit to how much I could volitionally do. And when I got to my 30s or something, my body started to break down. So my shoulders were chronically painful. So I couldn't keep swimming because I couldn't lift my arms above my shoulders. I couldn't keep running because my Achilles tendons went. I had chronic back pain at one point where I couldn't go back up. I couldn't even go up and down stairs because of the weakness in my left leg and the pain in my left leg. And I remember calling one of my brothers and saying, hey, Bill, I can't do all the things I used to do to keep myself happy. And when I look back now, I can see that my body was grinding me down. You know, people often say depression is the stop sign of the soul. that my body was going, I can't keep living ignoring this internal anxiety inside me that I'd spent my whole life, like we all do as teenagers or young people. It's like we try and make ourselves feel good and prop ourselves up rather than being guided and supported to go inwards and resolve some of this stuff. So one of my other brothers suggested I start doing try some Vipassana meditation, which is, those of you who don't know, it's generally you do it in a 10-day silent meditation course, or you're silent for about 8 days. And the process is primarily, there's a bit more to it, but just focusing on the sensations in your body over and over and over and over again. You just keep moving through your body, feeling whatever sensations are there. And on my third one of these courses, Michael, I was sitting there meditating. I got to the point where, you know, my mind had slowed down and I wasn't racing thoughts. I was just able to observe and notice. And then at some point as I was sitting in the hall, my body started to slowly lean forwards. And I just had the experience of like, that's really weird. I'm not doing that. And then as I let it keep leaning forwards, because I wasn't judging it, I wasn't trying to direct it, I was just observing, because that's what all the teachings from the Buddha are about. So I just kept observing. And then just as I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to fall forwards onto my face, my body sort of jolted. And then it slowly started to rock backwards. And again, I'm thinking, this is weird. I am not doing that. That's just happening on its own. And then again, I got so far back that I started to think, oh, shit, I'm going to fall over backwards. You know, we're in a silent meditation retreat. And then my body jolted and went forward. So I was aware of going, I'm meditating. I'm not doing this. Something else is making my body move. So what I did was I went back to the hall late at night after everyone had gone to bed, because you're not meant to move in these meditations. And many people listening to this will go, I experience this shaking and trembling or vibration or movements when I'm meditating, and I've always just shut it down because that's what everyone tells me. I've got to sit still. When I went back into the hall, I started meditating and I put all my awareness just on my right arm. And then my right arm started to move and spiral all on its own, all of a sudden going right up over the back of my head, like almost to the point where I'm thinking, my God, is it going to dislocate? And then it would jolt and then it would twist back the other way. Now, this is an arm that 2 days before I couldn't lift it above my shoulder. So I'm like, this is fascinating. So then I tried to put my awareness in both arms and they both started moving, then both legs, then my whole body, and then my whole body is moving itself and spinning around and spiraling around. And the thing was, Michael, was it felt absolutely ecstatic. The releasing, the stretching, the movement, the strength, the power, it was absolutely incredible. But it also came with this huge release of energy, and my mental speed was, you know, getting racier and racier and more sort of manicky, you know, everything's trying to interpret and make sense of it. And at that time, I was trying to understand it through my little physiotherapy models and brain, because that's all anyone had ever told me. So, oh, it's, you know, this neuromuscular pattern's happening and it gets to that and then it twists back and, you know, it's trying to make sense of it. But no one at the center, you know, they just said, look, stop meditating. And it took me on a very wild and woolly, I will start calling it now, when I came out of hibernation. I used to always say it was like my spiritual emergence/emergency. But also since the passing of Diva Dorica, what I now sort of stand and own it is saying that was my initiation into these other realms, whether it's shamanic or, you know, some other kind of wisdom traditions and stuff. But into there's more going on than just what we sort of know in the Western world. So that was the moment where, as I was coming back to life, I just had like superhuman strength beyond my wildest dreams. At one point, after a couple of days of just letting that meditation happen, I can remember my body spinning around and putting my feet up against the wall, having one hand. So I'm doing a one-handed handstand with my feet balancing against the wall. And I could push my body weight up and down as simply as I'm lifting my arm up and down in the sky now. So everything I'd been trained about strength training and growing strength and everything in my physiotherapy world, it just went out the window. I couldn't necessarily explain what the replacement was, but I was like, right, well, that's all bullshit because it takes months to grow the muscle and blah, 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 blah. And then a couple of other really fascinating things I want to share with you because you're a brain shaman. Which gets really fascinating because at this point, it's all making sense. This is all happening in my body's releasing and all that sort of stuff. So I'm rolling around the rolling around the my body's rolling me around the meditation hall, putting him into these all extreme positions, like one sort of shoulder stands on my ear. And then often what would happen is they'd get to the point where I'm going, this feels amazing. And then I'd get in and think, oh my God, I could break my neck here. And then there'd be a little jolt and it would go back the other way. So there was this pendulating between moving towards the fear and then feeling the freedom. And then at one point, I remember being, my body was up on a shoulder and an ear. I had my eyes closed and I was just about to topple over and I was scared. I was thinking, oh my God, am I going to break my neck here? It's all right. I'd go, if I thought I'm going to break my neck, I'd go, I've just gone into the future, come back and be present. So I'd recognize and go, right, that's a future thought, bring my mind back to the present and observe. And just as I was about to topple over, my toes just made the slightest little touch on a pot plant holder that I didn't even know was there and then started to spiral me back in the other direction. And in that moment, it occurred to me, like, I think my body knew that that was there. I had my eyes closed. I had no idea. So I started to have experience of like, wow, what's going on with my body's innate knowing and what's happening? It's somehow knowing what's going on around me. And that leads me to another story, if I may, was like, this is again with Dorita at one of the shaman's doorways. So he was talking to us about how our body has this perceptive fields around it, or he would describe as concentric rings of perception, you know, peripersonal space at, say, a meter, as long as your arms can reach. But then another one at like 4 or 5 meters, another one at 15, another one at 20, another one at 100 meters. You think, hang on, this doesn't necessarily make sense. So these days we would call it neuroception, or the body or the nervous system's ability to sense safety and danger around us outside the level of our conscious control. So I didn't know any of that at this point. So he gets all of us, we're inside in a hall, and what we would do is we'd have one person would stand facing away from everyone else, and then the people 5 or 6 meters behind them would put their hands out and kind of, however you could imagine it, sort of project energy like a light beam towards that other person. And what we had to do standing there was to notice as soon as we had some sensation in our legs, or sorry, some sensation in our body. So what would happen is as the person started to walk towards us, even though we've got our eyes closed and we can't see them, at some point you would feel a sensation. So for me, there was this little buzz in the outside of my left calf. And so what he would say, he'd say, right, well, when you feel some sensation, turn around, see where the person is. So I'm standing there with my eyes closed. My body, I get this little buzz in my calf. I turn around. My mind is thinking, this is all bullshit. I'm just making this up. I've just got an itch in my calf. This doesn't make sense. So, right, that person, it's 5 meters away. So he's like, right, well, there's one of your concentric rings that your body's sensing, the energy and things coming across that boundary. So you close your eyes again. The person keeps walking. They keep walking. And then buzz, there it is again. You turn around and they're like, right, your body's just picked up this next concentric ring. Again, this feeds back into this sense of validating your experience. At that point still, I'm like, I don't know if I'm making this shit up. Like, you know, I mean, I'm just turning around whenever I feel something. So who knows if there's really like rings there. So then what he does is Dorita takes us out into the bush or the forest. And now what we've got is we've got one man walks up the path about 50 meters away. The rest of us all standing in a group. And while that man's standing up there, someone would like push their hands out and try and project energy or whatever you want to do or intention or focus towards the back of that man up there who's got his eyes closed. And about 9 out of 10 people, as soon as someone pushed with their hands and had that intention, they all turned around. And we start thinking, wow, this is really fascinating. And then what would happen is people would walk up and they'd cross a little boundary and the person would feel it and they'd turn around. Now, Dorita being a trickster, what he started doing is as one person's walking up towards the man up the front, he would send the second bloke out pushing the energy towards the guy who's pushing towards the first guy to see if the second guy was embodied enough to feel that someone else was now trying to cross his boundaries, if that makes sense. So you've got two men walking up. Now, following on from my original story, I am just getting more and more insecure. Am I going to be able to do it? You know, in my mind, I picture myself standing there and never turning around and people coming up and touching me on the back because I can't do it. So when it comes to my turn, you know, part of that hyper anxiety is being really nervous system, hypersensitive and hyper aware. So I walk up to the up to take my turn up the front. I'm aware that Dorica can do all these tricky things to try and trick me, so I'm extra hyper alert. I go up there, I stand there, Michael, close my eyes. I'm waiting for any little buzz in that left part of my calf where I would feel that crossing. And I'm standing there and nothing's happening. And my mind's like, oh, my God, the guy must be halfway up. I can't do it. I'm missing all these things. What's going on? I'm used, you know, all those insecurities. I just stay there. It's taking ages and ages and ages. And then all of a sudden, there's a little buzz in my calf. So I swing around thinking I've got it. And when I turn around, there's no one behind me. And I look over and Dorica's taken all of the other, I don't know, 10 or 15 men, and they've gone off the path over into somewhere else, and they're all standing around having a conversation. So, of course, how do you think I feel? Oh, my God, I'm such a loser. That wasn't real. No one was coming up. That was wrong. Pathetic. I can't do all that sort of stuff. So, you know.
Barry from here.
Barry's back. Yeah.
Barry's back.
That's right. And eventually they send someone up behind me and it all happens, right? So we go over at the end of the exercise to debrief the conversation. Again, I'm just thinking, oh, I'm so embarrassed. I thought I could do this stuff, but I'm useless. And so then he starts talking about what everyone was experiencing. He was laughing about how he sent someone up behind someone else and they weren't aware enough to feel it. And then he looks at me and he goes, and you little prick, you turned around when I simply mentioned your name when we were talking off over there in that group. So, again, I had this another little aha moment. Wow, this is – so I wasn't wrong. I was picking up on not someone walking through a concentric, you know, a concentric ring of awareness or boundary, but simply the mention of my name was hypersensitive enough to pick that up. Now, extraordinary experience, but I want to translate that into something that's relevant for the rest of our listeners. And our latest, again, neuroscientific concepts and developed by Stephen Porges, the developer of polyvagal theory, is this concept of neuroception. And the way he describes it is that our nervous system is constantly scanning our environment for cues of safety or danger. But not only our external environment, it's also scanning our internal environment. Those messages are coming back to the brain, because most of the information in the vagus nerve, that the wanderer, the great parasympathetic nerve, are traveling from the body back up to the brain. And so what can happen is our body's senses of what's safe and what's dangerous can be very misconstrued in a sense. So I don't know if you're like me, but I've always heard the term, the body never lies. Well, I hear it all the time. Whereas what I'd like to propose to you is the body lies all the bloody time. So, for example, if you were bitten by a black scary dog as a child, as I said before, and someone brings you in a fluffy white puppy that's 2 days old, it's still got its eyes closed, you're in absolute zero danger, but the body's freaking out as if there's danger here. So we can have this concept where we can have misperception or misneuroception. Now, in one sense, the body's not lying, because the body's showing us that we've got this unresolved pattern or trauma that's associated with dogs in this case. And it's also to do with our mind and our ego. For me, in some ways, our ego is nothing more than just some sort of big bag or sack of past memories projected onto the future. And so when we have these...
And it's bigger than dogs, right? We do this with...
We do this with everything.
I think that the biggest thing is we do this with people. I have a feeling that you might have been like me, where in adolescence I was socially cut off. You know, basically, you know, the penis gets circumcised and cut off, and as a baby, we exit the womb and we're gasping for breath. This happens a lot in adolescence, going through puberty a lot of times, even earlier childhood. A lot of kids get socially isolated, cut off from the social tribe, and they're alone.
Yep.
And that creates a sort of fear mechanism. I mean, when I'm also very sensitive to my name being called. And when I hear my name, I never thought about this until now, but I jerk my head and it's like I'm desperate to hear my name or I'm scared to hear my name. Yep. But it's definitely sort of a lot of sympathetic arousal attached to my name.
Yep.
And maybe I'm wrong, but if you had a lot of anxiety, maybe you were also sort of socially cut off when you were younger. And I think I'm still haven't quite re-entered the social realm. I'm trying to trust people and not be scared of people and to reconnect with that larger pulsating vibe that goes through human to human. You're maybe further on in that journey than me. So how did you begin to, or maybe you haven't, begin to reconnect with people in this pure sort of vibrational way where you're actually trusting of them and you're not scared anymore and you're full human animal once again. You're not this alone creature that you were when you were, you know, a teenager or whatever.
Yeah, you're 100% right, Michael, because, you know, research would suggest that for many, many people, and I would suggest this is more males than females, the fear of public speaking is rated as more scary than the fear of dying. So there's a fear of social death or death of the ego and exclusion. You know, we can go, right, if I'm isolated and rejected by my tribe, that's death. But it's not just physical death. It's actually purpose and meaning and connection death. So I had experience at boarding school where I saw myself as the sort of runt of the, in terms of the psycho-emotional hierarchy. We in Australia, we used to call this, when I went to boarding school, ragging. These days you'd call it bullying, but it wasn't just on one person. We all bullied everyone else. So whatever your deepest insecurity was, that would become your nickname and you'd be called that relentlessly. So it wasn't until many years later after doing a lot of TRE that when I went back to boarding school for the first time in like 25 years, because it had a mixture of amazing memories and horrendous memories, that I came to realize that I'd been living in extreme hypervigilance for 4 years at boarding school, constantly hypervigilant about being shamed. And so while I didn't have a life and death physical trauma, I can go, wow, I had 4 years of like just chronic overwhelm, shutdown, hyper internalized anxiety over that period of time. How do we start to come out of that? And part of the solution, I mean, again, there's everything we do, but comes out of the story and the work of David Berselli, because again, remember, these patterns are not conscious. You know, you're not cognitively choosing to snap your head around as soon as you hear your name. They're physiological patterns. So the solution is going to be also in the body, because that's where the protective mechanisms are. They're not wrong or bad. They're just holding and waiting until our organism and our life and grace and the universe is ready to give us the next sort of opening or piece of the puzzle. So when David Berselli, the TRE founder, first started teaching TRE, he was working with conflict resolution between Israelis and Palestinians. And he said what would happen is you'd have two people would come in or groups of people would come in. They're all angry. They're all hurt. They're all charged up. And you're trying to do conflict resolution with people whose nervous systems are in absolute fight and flight mode or overwhelm. It just was almost impossible. So he decided to introduce using this neurogenic tremor reflex first before doing any of the talking. And what he found was when he got people to tremor and their nervous system, again, for want of a better word, calmed down, came out of those habituated defensive hypervigilant states with the other, and they'd lay down on the floor all in the room and they all found their nervous system calmed down. When they got up and their physiology was calm, he said, then what happened is they started to relate to each other as human beings. Wow, I've lost a son, you've lost a son, because their system was out of that hypervigilance. So what I'm saying is, how I started to come out of those chronic anxiety patterns, and it's not like it's a just click your fingers and everything's necessarily gone. It's like a process of growth and grounding and healing, was using this spontaneous shaking and tremoring mechanism to help my nervous system downregulate. Because when the nervous system is downregulated, you automatically start to feel the safety inside you. And from that place, you're able to start to engage with the world around us from a place of curiosity. Like people say, you've got to have a curious mindset, but curiosity is an innate part of a safe and grounded organism as a child. But if you haven't had those experiences, you can't pretend curiosity, because your physiology is not looking for exploration and new experiences. It's trying to protect itself and survive. So that was a really key piece of the puzzle for me, was finding this way where all of a sudden I had a healthy way, a natural way, an innate way that I could use on my own to help my nervous system relax, let go, calm down, ground, to start to get more embodied and to move through all those unresolved tension and bracing and overwhelm and disconnection patterns that I'd been carrying in my body. And then from having those experiences, like being at a TRE workshop, feeling that peace, interacting with people, that starts to re-pattern the experience. You go, wow, I'm having these great, calm, connected experiences with people rather than only sort of pretending to be calm but internally overwhelmed, going, no, I'm actually feeling internally really like present and open and curious and friendly and innately inside our body. And there's a young, amazing young guy called Jonah Robbins from the USA who teaches TRE. His father teaches TRE as well. They're both quite incredible. But Jonah in a podcast one day, I'll never forget him talking about that the great sadness of our times in Western society is that most of us are living in hugely painful and uncomfortable bodies. David Berselli says the same thing. You know, life kind of is ultimately meant to feel pleasurable, to feel alive. Most of us are just living in chronically shut down, immobilized, disconnected, numb, overwhelmed bodies, primarily in our Western culture, that we think we're so advanced and all that sort of stuff, but the body hasn't been brought along and integrated in the way that many, many other traditional Indigenous cultures always understood, knew about, and incorporated into their well-being.
In what ways is Western medicine making us more numb and disconnected?
Well, so again, it's a bit like the tool and how we use it. So if you've got a headache, what do people take? A Panadol or take a whatever Zyrtex. I don't know what you call them, not Zyrtex, whatever you call them, Tylenol or whatever they are in whatever country. So there's generally a model of you've got pain, do something, fix it. So it's a linear model. You know, you've got a knee problem. Great. Let's cut it out, put a plastic one, go back and keep living the exact same life you were living that led to this problem, but now without pain because we've fixed the pain for you. Rather than saying, gee, the reason your knee's breaking down is because you are out of relationship with your body, yourself, your food, your diet, your breath, your relationships, your purpose. And ultimately what I would say in our Western world, and again, this is something that's really coming forwards for me more and even more and more since Derecha's passing, is we're out of a reverent or sacred relationship with life, with others and life around us, because our culture just doesn't give us that. You know, we're not trained that the healing and growth is probably going to be difficult at times. You know, I like to say to people, you can't go to the gym and just pick up the 2 kilo weights all the time and think you're going to get stronger. You have to struggle and feel the, you know, the way we grow muscular strength is literally those muscle fibers tear because it's heavier than what they can cope with, and then they regenerate. But we rarely, unless you're working, you know, with psychotherapists or people who understand this stuff in a therapeutic model, we don't have a culture which says, hey kids, this is what's going to happen. You're going to go through traumatic experiences. That's part of life. It's going to help you grow and heal, and we need to support you and guide you through that so that you can be in a deeper relationship, as I say, with yourself, with others, and the world around us, a little bit more sacredness and reverence. Can I share another story? Because this again is relevant.
Oh yeah, go for it. I love, this is the best, and you've got tons of stories. Share a million of them.
I've got lots of stories.
I love your stories.
So at the shaman's doorway, I'll never forget again, Derecha said this, and it just stuck out so much to me, because I've spent most of my life, you know, I eat addictively, chocolate, sugar. I've never really got into drugs or alcohol that much. I've never smoked, but just the food. But, you know, we all have our addictive behaviors and patterns. Or the other ones I had would be I often pick scabs. So it has a special name. It's kind of an OCD or a repetitive body-based behavior sort of thing. So
yeah, I used to bite my fingernails off in junior high school.
Yeah. So I always say, this is a bit rude, but I always say I had the 3 Ps. I had picking, pulling, and putting things in my mouth. By pulling, I mean like masturbating. Ideally sex if I could have sex, but often masturbating. So these were these compulsive behaviors that when I was stressed, that was kind of trying to get the release. So when we talk about putting things in the mouth, you know, chocolate, junk food. And I'll never forget Derecha saying, he said this, all the substances of addiction are sacred substances that we have lost our sacred relationship with. And I started to think about that. Tobacco. Yeah, right. Think about Native American. Chocolate, cacao. Sugar. I don't know the origins of the sugar story, but it started to make sense. Right. Even sex. We've fallen out of deep reverence and sacred relationship with all of these substances or experiences. and we've turned them into consumptive things with no meaning and no purpose and no...
It's become entertainment or just pure pleasure.
Entertainment and ultimately no respect, and it's no relationship.
And a disconnected experience.
Yeah, that's right. There's no reverence. There's no relationship. And I did this 2 years advanced diploma in Aboriginal studies at an Aboriginal organisation called Trambie Aboriginal College in Sydney. So it was run, an entire organisation was run and set up for Aboriginal people, but they let non-Aboriginals like myself come in and do the course or do some of the course. And at the end of that 2 years, we had to hand in our final sort of assessment. And we could do it however we wanted because it was in Indigenous culture. And I just remember walking up to my teacher and saying, oh, I've got it. I've learnt the content. I'm going to hand in my final assignment right now. He said, yep, that's great. And we were sitting having lunch and all my colleagues were all just sitting around eating. And I just said to him, it's all about relationship. And he just smiled and said, yep, great, thanks. So what I'm saying there is for me, that was the learning that I got out of not the only learning, but the central learning that was missing in my life and my culture, that the Indigenous cultures of Australia are carrying and maintaining, is this sense of reverence and relationship for life. So on the weekend, when just on the weekend gone, we had a little ceremony because there was no big funeral for Dorica and I wanted to do something. There was a few other people. So we got four of us together. And as part of this little sort of ritual where we had this amazing ritual. So what I said to everyone is I got everyone to bring along a substance that they have an addictive relationship with. And we were going to consume or ingest this substance in a sacred manner in honor of Dorica. This was part of it. And so, you know, I brought along a little tube of raw sugar. Someone else bought sugar. Someone else bought salty chips. Someone else bought tobacco or something like that. Now, what's fascinating is that when we look at research into addiction with cocaine and sugar, where people have got rats addicted to cocaine, rats addicted to sugar, the research shows that the rats that are addicted to sugar will jump higher over barriers to get to the sugar than the rats will jump over to get to cocaine. So you know, our whole culture is just full of sugar. And as I say, I don't even know any story to do with the sacred use or origins of sugar. Probably someone does. I don't know, but most of us wouldn't. We don't think of sugar as a sacred substance, but it probably has. So what was fascinating for me, Michael, is I'd managed to access some copal, I think it's pronounced copal resin, which is like a resin from a copal plant in Mexico, because Dorica had had his first big sort of shamanic awakening in Mexico with this culture. And so I put a bit of this copal resin on the fire. We had just let it all burn down to coals. And as soon as I put these crystals on, all of a sudden, poof, there's this huge, big flames, all just amazing. And then there's this little bit of a smell. So after doing this was this process. So we all sat around and we're like, right, we're going to ingest our addictive substance. So I take my little packet of, you know, raw sugar. I suck out half of the sugar, put some on the fire. And when I put that sugar on the fire, do you know what happened, Michael? Whoosh, huge, big flames, exactly the same as this sacred copal resin, you know, resin. And I was like, wow, that is fascinating. And then as each person ingested, you know, the little tiny bit of their substance, what happened to me is as soon as I ingested that, I started to get a shake and a tremor in my chest. My body started to move and I could feel little palpitations in my heart, like there was more energy and there was more excitement and there was more whatever. So each person ingested their substance, put a little bit on the fire, and then we sat there to see what the effect was. You know, normally I might have a can of Coke I don't drink lots of Coke, but, you know, a can of soft drink or something and think nothing of it. And yet here I am in this sacred way having half a teaspoon of sugar, and I can feel that my heart rate sped up and my heart's starting to sort of palpitate. And then it occurred to me to everyone when that all ingested, I said to them at the end, I was kind of half joking, but I said to them, right, how was your trip? Sort of joking. You know, if we'd all taken ayahuasca, we'd go, right, we've been on a trip. If we've all taken a psychedelic, we're saying we're going on a trip, but we're taking sugar and tobacco and salt, you know, salty chips. We don't think of that as a trip, because we don't go, wow, what's the effect that this substance is having on me? So we're not in that relationship. And each one of us could say, wow, as soon as I had this substance, I felt this. This happened, which was incredible. So, you know, starting to change the relationship with sugar rather than just the craving. But what was also amazing that came to me in that moment, Michael, was that it occurred to me was, what was the sugar giving me in that moment? So I could say energy, excitement, movement. I tend to be someone whose system's quite lethargic often and low energy. And then it occurred to me that when I'm trying to consume these substances, what I'm really doing is looking for an external fill for an internal experience that I'm having trouble connecting with in myself. So rather than going, gee, I'm feeling low energy, there's energy inside me, I need to go inside, find that, move, do all that sort of thing. It's like, just give me the quick hit, give me the sugar. There's the energy. So that in our addictions and the compulsions in our entire society, in my opinion, is largely because we're looking externally for the source. I also like to joke, you know, so, you know, you're eating a meal. You put the tomato sauce in Australia, we call the tomato ketchup, you might call it in America. You put the tomato sauce on, spelled S-A-U-C-E, with sugar, which is basically red sugar with a bit of tomato in it, because we're looking for the source outside ourselves rather than the source within ourselves, the S-O-U-R-C-E. So we have these cravings because we're disconnected from the innate vitality or the security or the embodiment or the attachment inside ourselves, and we look for that externally. And this, again, is part of the great magic of using the spontaneous movements of TRE, but also breath work, mindfulness, all the different – everything that we do, psychedelics, absolutely everything we're doing is trying to get us connected back to this sense of, wow, I'm alive, there's energy, there's movement, there's this extraordinary experience going on. But again, no one's telling that in – there aren't any ads at halftime on the Super Bowl saying, hey, guys, the reason you want that Coke and that Pepsi is because you're craving a connection with something that's already inside you. Here you go. Come and buy this and you can get it out here and you're going to feel good, because the people who are doing that and selling that to us just don't have that connection internally themselves either. So as a Western culture, in a way, it's like we've lost our
– But in the end, it seems like these external things that give us this – big spike in energy, dopamine and adrenaline and stuff, they in the end sort of disconnect us from the overall flow of energy.
Yes.
Because what you're saying like echoes back to everything all these people at Stanford have been doing for the past like 20 years. It started with the marshmallow test, you know, and the kids got the spike of you know, energy and dopamine and everything from that marshmallow, and they didn't wait. But the kids who sort of took the pain, and they knew that pain was part of that process of pleasure.
Yep.
They ended up, in the end, following the pain, there was more pleasure and it's more smooth ride, and that natural flow of pain and pleasure
yep.
went up and down. And then you get people like Carol Dweck, same community at Stanford, growth mindset versus fixed mindset. You know, you can grow, and part of that growth is pain. There's this other lady there, Alia Crum. She has this thing, this philosophy or whatever, called stress is enhancing mindset. And once you believe that stress is actually
yep. good
enhancing you, that pain yep. is part of the process, then you're going to embrace and you're going to go into that darkness. You're going to do that dark night of the soul thing, and you're going to come out better ahead. And there's more and more people. There's another lady that Anna Lemke, the one who wrote Dopamine Nation, also at Stanford. Yep. What the heck? There's like a trend going on. There's a community of people there over yep. decades doing this. And she talks about how there's this pain pleasure balance, this pain pleasure seesaw. And so the more you sort of spike up the pleasure, and you don't naturally following pleasure, say you're taking cocaine or you're eating sugar or something, there is like mathematically there's going to be a crash, there's going to be a pain that's yep. actually equal or greater to that pleasure that you felt before. So the next day there will be a hangover, and if you immediately jump back to pleasure, it's going to break the hinge on that seesaw basically, and you're going to be stuck in pain. Mm. You know, and it's not even going to be feel good, the pleasure's not coming back. But if you just sit there and wait and embrace the pain, naturally your body's going to regenerate that energy, and you're going to be able to yep. feel pleasure once again naturally. And then you can go, but like people are, they're cutting off the pain. through the medications and through just constantly consuming the pleasurable thing he wants to get again. And then it breaks the whole flow of energy. So like, it's like, whoa, this is finally coming to light, but slowly, slowly.
So let's take that. Okay. Because pain is a verb. The latest neuroscience is very clear. To put it simply, all pain is a defensive output of the brain. So often we go, I've got pain, I'm in pain. But the exact same way where we can go, little fluffy white puppy that we brought in, and your body starts to generate anxiety, the nervous system, for want of a better word, is generating the pain, because pain's generally designed to do one of two things. In mobilization, it's to make us move, like you touch something hot, you pull your hand away. But then when it becomes chronic, it's designed to prevent us from moving. Get tight. Don't have that movement in the neck. Don't let your breath be full, because you're going to feel grief, or you might feel sadness, or whatever it is. So the same thing is, we look at pain, and this is not to discount the value of medication and when it's required and used, but no one's, thankfully, people are starting to go, hang on, pain is an output of the brain. It's a defensive output of the brain. So again, that starts to go, right, my system is generating this. It's not saying it's all in my head and I'm making it up. It's like saying, oh, you're making up your anxiety when you see the dog. In a way you are. Your body and your mind are making it up, saying this is dangerous, but it's not really making it up, because it's saying, I remember this experience deep in the physiology that was unresolved and overwhelming, and I never really got over it to the point where my body says that has completed and finished and it's done. It's the same with all these pain responses. And again, this is the beauty of the tremor mechanism or the shaking, but it could be crying, it could be laughing, because that's how a diaphragm releases. The value of reinstating this recovery or this release or this relaxation response, which is what most of us lose, again, in our Western culture. None of us ever lose the capacity for our nervous system to ramp up to maximum capacity. Like, if we're sitting here making this podcast or someone's listening to it and there's a massive explosion outside your house, all of our nervous systems are going to go bang straight up to 500 kilometers an hour. What we tend to lose then is the ability to go from 500 kilometers an hour back to, oh, that was a car backfiring, stand down, relax. Our body's still pumped full of adrenaline, cortisol, and we lose the ability to switch it off. So this is where the shaking's not caused by adrenaline after a shock. You have an adrenaline release, which is designed to generate movement. And if the body doesn't move, the shaking is how the body uses up that adrenaline to restore it back down to homeostasis. It's how it uses up the cortisol to get those levels back down, because the chemicals are in the blood. So it's not just the nervous system's got to switch off. It's also going, right, well, we've still got all these pumped up chemicals. How do we help to restore them? So we got onto that because of pain. So again, there's a whole thing around pain. We tend to think of pain as a noun. It's something outside me. It's something that's happening to me. I'm in it. It's like I'm swimming in it, rather than going, wow, pain is something that my organism, for want of a better word at the moment, is generating. And it's understandable, because we're not consciously, volitionally creating those responses. So we feel like it's outside ourselves. But as we get more embodied, and this is where I think, you know, breath work and breathing is such a critical and amazing process, because I'm doing some breath work training with an amazing Australian physio who lives in America called Campbell Will from Functional and Therapeutic Breath Work. And the way he describes it, he says, you know, the breath is like the remote control for the nervous system. And when we can learn to get embodied into our breathing and start to change that, we get amazing capacity to consciously start to switch off or downregulate or calm the nervous system, so it's not firing out those outputs. And for me, I think that's an incredible balance when you've got the spontaneous movements of TRE, which is downregulating or releasing or reorganizing the system that's outside of our volitional control, combined with the skills and the tools, whether it's mindfulness, whether it's breath work, whether it's exercise, you know, all the different stuff we use, to cognitively calm ourselves and relax ourselves down, you know, combine that with diet, combine that with relationships, and ultimately combine that with relationships with purpose, sacredness of life, then I think we've got a solution for sort of the struggles that we have on our planet in our westernized consuming sort of cultures.
Yeah, and just recognize that the pain is not a bad thing, that stress is not a bad thing, but it's just part of the cycle of pleasure and energy in life. And then you can sort of reframe it. When you encounter these pains or these struggles or even death itself, you know, you can see of like, oh, this is just part of the life, and that you stop running away from it or covering it up or numbing yourself out of it. And then like, it's really scary at first, you know, like I also had some scary dog experiences as a kid and I still have it, but maybe I should just embrace the dog and pet the dog and get over it. But I'm still like, it's like jumping into the cold water. You know, it looks really painful. Yep. So you're running away from it, but just jump in. And then at the end, it's like, yeah. For example, you know, think about the time when you were a kid and you rode a roller coaster for the first time. In America, it'd be like at Disneyland, it'd be Space Mountain or something. And you're like, no, I'm not going on it. No, no, no. And you go on it and you're like, I want to go again. I want to go again. So like, we're scared of things, but then, once we jump into it, the light comes out much more quicker than we think it will. And that's, it's not going to happen if you run away. You're just going to go, you're going to be stuck in the pain.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's the exhilaration and Peter Levine, the founder of Somatic Experiencing, you know, has got a famous quote where he says, you can't have it both ways. You can't shut down feelings and sensations of terror and fear and not feel those and then want to have, you know, massive experiences of exhilaration and joy, because once the nervous system or the body starts to pulsate at a certain level of excitement, you can't just go, yeah, I'll have 500 kilometers of excitement and joy, thanks, but I only want 50 kilometers per hour of suffering or terror or anger or fear. It's like the systems kind of gets capped at where whatever our capacity is. And that's where going into and moving through those states in our physiology and allowing our body to move us starts to reawaken us and bring back our capacity to feel more. You know, there's a famous saying, I can't remember who said it, whether it was Joe Lipton or someone. I don't think it was, it might've been Dispenza. Anyway, you know, if you want to feel better, you've got to get better at feeling. So that sense of we need to get reconnected to the body, because, you know, what we're talking about here is like fear and excitement are opposite ends of the same stick. You know, the nervous system's pretty much the same response. It's just our interpretation. I'm in danger. This is terrifying. I'm on the roller coaster. This is fun. But physiologically, pretty much similar things are happening. And so I want to share another story, experience I had, which is was really profound for me. So 10 or 12 years ago, I was involved with a group of other men as volunteers setting up a men's gathering in Australia called Menergy. It was part of a bigger men's wellbeing organisation in Queensland that was running events, but we started our own one in Victoria. And we had a sort of a scout camp, a YMCA sort of, you know, school camp area that we used, and we ran the first 3 years at this place called Grantville down near Phillip Island outside Melbourne in Australia. And at the site, there was a labyrinth that had been made. It was a replica, I think, of the one from Charters, however you pronounce that, in France. And it had stones and it had all been marked out, but it hadn't been completed and there weren't enough stones. So over the 3 years that we were at Menergy, one of the things we did was we bought rocks and we got people to help us create, you know, fill in all the rocks to make this amazing labyrinth. Now, after 3 years, and this men's gathering, like 200 men, it was like, I say, it's the best 3 or 4 days of my life every year, because I'm in a group of people who are all, you know, trying to be as genuine and authentic and open-hearted and nurturing and caring group of men, rather than normal experiences of big groups of men, which aren't necessarily always that safe or friendly. So I had a deep affinity and connection for this land at Grantville. And then the fourth year, the organising committee decided we needed a bigger venue, so they found a bigger venue somewhere else and we were moving away from Grantville. And I felt this deep, deep grief and sadness because I had this beautiful connection with this land down there. So I organised a gratitude or grief sort of thing for Grantville. I think it was called, you know, Gratitude for Grantville or something. So a number of us went back to the site. We went and helped clean up the labyrinth again. We got in there and then we walked into the labyrinth. We sat in the middle of the labyrinth and we all kind of just shared a little bit about what we're experiencing. So, you know, people like, oh, I'm so grateful. I'm so this, I'm so that. And in my life, I'd always felt like I wasn't very good at feeling grateful. I could feel excited or selfish, or but I always thought I'm not very good at feeling gratitude. You know, I'd keep a gratitude diary. I'd try and think myself grateful. I'd do all these sorts of things. So when it got to my turn, Michael, I start talking about this land and what it means to me and this event, and I just start bawling my eyes out. I am crying and sobbing like uncontrollably, like if you're having laughter where you can hardly breathe. I'm like that as I'm talking. And the whole time, you know, it's happening. And then at the end of that sharing, I sort of stop crying and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, guys. I'm just so full of grief. You know, I'm just always feeling the sadness and the loss. And one of my friends said to me, he goes, oh, were you feeling grief? I thought you were just feeling gratitude. And it hit me in this moment. All of a sudden I thought, hang on. I thought gratitude just only ever meant feeling happy and smiley and joyful. And in that moment, what I experienced was that, for me at least, grief and gratitude are like opposite ends of the same stick. These days, what I tend to say is, if I'm not crying, I'm not really feeling my gratitude. You know, I'm not feeling that real absolute depth of heart opening. You know, like you say, when your mum passed away, we go through these deep crying and the loss, and then that same flowing sort of love. And I'm sure it's all a bit mixed in and complicated, but I find it's really relevant, because, you know, most of us constantly have been trying to avoid crying, to stop crying. And in a way, crying is the ultimate release of grief and loss and sadness, and potentially the ultimate way of connecting in with gratitude and love and appreciation and open-heartedness as well. So I hope that for some people out there, if you're like me, who when you're only crying and you're thinking you're just feeling grief, that you might start to open up to thinking, wow, maybe this is actually about, I might be feeling some gratitude here as well at the same time.
These sort of spontaneous movements like crying and like laughing from the bottom of your heart and all these things, it kind of unfreezes you. You're not unfreezing yourself, but it sort of unfreezes you. It takes you out of that hibernation and it reconnects you with the natural sort of flowing of energy. And people might think, oh, crying, you must be sad, or you're grieving, you must be sad. But it's like, it's weirdly beautiful when you embrace that, because it's like you're reconnected to all this stuff. And it's like, whoa, when you can start to see that these things that look like opposites are not actually opposites, but they're sort of two sides of the same seesaw. Life just goes on, and it's like, wow, this is super, super nice. And then you don't have to feel so bad, and you can start to embrace new experiences and change your identity as well. Cause you might think, oh, I'm terrible at sports, or I'm not someone who grieves, or I'm not someone who feels gratitude. Yeah. And then like by going to that thing that it's just everything changes.
That's right. It opens a doorway.
These days, a lot of people have, a lot of these supposed disorders and things, like, I know you're not a doctor, but ADHD, OCD, bipolar disorder and stuff. The more I learn about polyvagal theory and the stuff we're talking about, and just the brain itself, it makes me think that maybe there might be something, there might be some behavioral ways, you know, the way we move our bodies, or the way we move our eyes, or the way we just move, that might be worth exploring as ways to prevent or treat some of this. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe we do need the pharmaceuticals, but my feeling is that these increasing rates of ADHD and all these other things might be tied to the way we are moving or not moving these days. And this isn't the way I wanted to end the podcast, but I do have that question. Do you think TRE and things like that can help, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say on an individual level, absolutely. This capacity for movement and flexibility, or David Bersoli, the TRE founder, uses the concept of pulsation. You know, we're designed to dance between states of self-protection and then sort of opening up. You know, think about cells in our digestive system. You know, if we're always open, if your cell walls are always open, you're going to have leaky gut and irritable bowel. If they're always closed, you're going to have problems the other way around. So just like cells, we're designed to open and close and pulsate and have, you know, some things come in, sometimes they come out, to go into states of shutting down and bracing and then coming back out the other side. It's part of the pulsation of life. But I would come back to, for me, Michael, is at an individual level, yes, there's that capacity to move, but I would come back to, you know, I think all of these things are linked to the lack of respect and reverence and relationship we have for the world in, again, primarily in sort of westernized, Christianized cultures, where there was that belief came in that, you know, humans are on top of the tree and the world's here to serve us and be our, to be used for our bounty. And again, that links in with kind of like a lot of the English sort of medical tradition, where a lot of our westernized medicines come out of that, and they have that concept of the stiff upper lip. You know, don't be vulnerable, don't let your body move, don't let it be free. And we have a real culture that it's all up to me. You know, I need to make this happen. If I'm successful, it's because of me. We've lost that sense of going, you know, even think about the film The Secret. Oh, I can manifest whatever I want. You know, the reality is, when I think that I'm manifesting something, everything else in the entire universe has to align for me to have that experience. We rarely sit back and say, wow, I give thanks to grace or God or the universe or spirit or whatever you want to call it, that I'm afforded this experience. Sure, I've had to do my own little bit. I've had to swim in the river in a certain direction, but we lose the sense of the river or the great flow of life or something bigger than ourselves or everything that's outside of ourselves, you know, very much focused in our own individualistic, egotistical sense of self, well-being. Western medicine is, you know, only starting to look at the bigger picture that a lot of Eastern traditions would look at, in terms of, you know, you can't be a happy, healthy individual if the people around you are not also happy and healthy. You can't be a happy, healthy individual if the land and the animals and the plants and the trees and the air around us is not also healthy. And slowly we're learning that the hard way. But like all things, stress and trauma and overwhelm, there seems to be some innate organizational intelligence, which is, painful as it is, this is the pathway that appears to also be moving us forwards.
How can people learn more about you or connect with you?
So it's probably my main website contact is treaustralia.com at the moment. But I'm probably moving more towards doing a little bit more of my own thing. But in a way, what I'd suggest is it's not so important to connect with me as much as to connect to their own body, their own physiology, their own family, yeah, friends, and the world around them. So when we had COVID, living in Melbourne, which was the most lockdown city in the entire world, because I couldn't travel for my work, I received some government funding, like lots of us, we had, you know, like payments from the government to keep us surviving and functioning. So I created a free online course, which is, again, you can find that through the TRE Australia website, or you can go straight to trecourse.com. And there's a screening tool. So if you've got a history of major stress and anxiety or mental health or trauma, that sort of thing, then it will guide you where you can learn the technique with a provider, and they're in about 80 countries around the world. Or if you feel confident to do the self-guided learning yourself, there's 3 sessions there. There's a bit of background information, but most importantly, it's really not about the information. It's just learning how to give your body the wisdom in your body, the time and space to start to move and to move you and to reorganize itself. So, I mean, what I'd say is getting in touch with me is less important than getting in touch with yourself, and a brilliant way to do that in amongst all the other techniques we have is to do that free online course at trecourse.com.
That's the best answer ever. I don't know why, but there's like this cheesy way that people end podcasts, like every time, like, how can people connect with you? And it's like, I don't think we even want to ask this question, and we don't really want to be like, okay, and how often do people actually connect with the person anyway? But it's like a thing we naturally do. And the deeper thing is connecting to, yeah, your body and connecting to the world and connecting to information in general. So yeah, forget about connecting with you, but I guess if people want to, they'll find you. You mentioned a couple tools that we can use to connect with our bodies. One is TRE, one is breath. Some are behavioral tools, some are other ones. Even if we don't have time to explain it because we're about to go, if you can just spit out some random words, it might be Feldenkrais, it might be anything, that something other tools that people can kind of Google and search on their own that might be ways to reconnect with their body. I know it's just meditating and being there, but it is helpful to have some organized practices like TR. If you got any others?
Oh, look, I would say everything and anything, follow your intuition. If it's Pilates, if it's yoga, if it's dance, if it's walking the dog, if it's all of those, all and any of those sort of things, to help connect and to help move, really. It's like movement is life. And, even doing the breath work training, we often have, you hear it all the time. It's like breath is life. Life is breath. But it's interesting for me because before we even have that breath, we've got movement in utero. You know, ultimately breath is movement. The air goes in and out because of the movement in the body. So, I would just say, you know, follow your intuition. Trust yourself. Whatever appeals to you and brings your body alive,
yeah,
then I would say follow that, because there are millions and thousands of different techniques and different processes that are out there. So definitely I would, and David Berselli, the Terry founder, you know, he's really, I am a great gift, a great sort of, not a debt really, but I've received a great gift that I'm very grateful for him, was about modeling this whole sense of just going to your own body, going to your own experience, be with your body. So anything that's going to help you get connected to yourself and then to others in the world around you is going to be a good way to go.
I think a cool idea of what you're talking about is, you know, we don't know how to move and we don't know how to exercise, but we have this intuitive feel. I like to, now that you talked about this whole baby in the womb thing, I'm going to sort of imagine sometimes that I'm still a baby in the womb, and how would I move if this whole world was the womb? You know, there's a heartbeat and there's the mother's blood flowing through me, like around me, kind of moving me, and she's talking and I can hear her voice vibrating me. And maybe it's not her voice, but it's like, it's a thunder. It's the ground underneath my feet, or the sun in the sky, and the people around me, and like, well, I am in the womb still, and just let it vibrate and move me in the way it does. And then you can kind of just let go. And that's a fun exercise. Just even if it's not true, I think that's a fun way to live. Just pretend like you're still in the womb being moved.